Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello there, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for joining us. On this episode, I'm speaking again with biochemist Michael Behe, professor of biological sciences at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania, and a senior fellow at Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Behe is author of Darwin's Black Box, which was named one of the 100 most important books of the 20th century by National Review and World Magazine, and the follow-up The Edge of Evolution. Michael, welcome back to ID the Future.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. It's always a pleasure.
Today, we continue our series exploring the content of your new book, Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolution. It's published by Harper One. On this episode, we'll focus on the first couple chapters of part three of your book. Now, for those who haven't heard the first two episodes in this series, let's start with a quick review. In part one of your book, you look at the major problems any theory attempting to account for life must face. That includes the issue of how we know what we claim to know, and you give an account of the astonishing biological systems of elegance and complexity that demand explanation. In part two, you examine a number of ideas that have been offered as answers for the origin and development of these systems, from Darwin's own theory to the most recent non-Darwinian accounts of evolution. Now, in part three, you turn your attention to data from a host of recent experiments and studies, and you tell us what they reveal about the neo-Darwinian paradigm. Now, you point out something in Darwin Devolves that I think is extremely helpful to remember as we consider the limits of Darwinian evolution. The type of detailed and rigorous evolutionary studies we need to stringently test Darwin's theory have only recently been made possible due to major advances in laboratory techniques. So this happens to be the best time in the history of the field to be studying and drawing conclusions about neo-Darwinism and its limits. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. An analogy I like to use is that the speculations about what was driving evolution before about 20, 25 years ago are of no more account than theories about the universe were before the invention of the telescope. You know, without a telescope, you simply couldn't see very far to think about what the universe might be like. And without the new developments in technology that allow us to look at DNA sequences pretty easily and in large numbers, nobody knew what those random mutations were that were the fodder for natural selection, for Darwin's mechanism.
Yeah, it's just so important to remember this, because you hear a lot of critics of intelligent design say, oh, Darwinian evolution is time-tested, it's established, it's unassailable, how could you possibly question it? Well, actually, we have technology that is showing that it's a great time to question it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you got to remember that in order to test Darwin's theory, you have to look at the molecular level of life, because that's where the action is. The DNA and changes in DNA are molecular changes, and they code for changes in the proteins, which are the molecular machines that drive the cell. So if you can't see to the molecular level, then you just don't know what is causing these changes. And we've only gained that ability in the past couple decades.
Well, in Chapter 6, you point out that Darwinian processes nicely account for changes at the species and genus levels of biological classification, but not so much for changes at the level of family or higher. How does data from more recent studies of Darwin's finches illustrate this?
Well, let me give a little bit of background first. Most people have heard of Darwin's finches, the Galapagos finches, and they're kind of a paradigm of evolution. You know, pretty much every biology textbook has them. And it shows different species of these birds that have apparently come into being on those islands from an ancestor species, diversified into ones with different beak shapes and so on. But it's interesting, if you think about the levels of biological classification, if you remember back to your biology, there's classifications called domain and kingdom and phylum and class, order, and so on. There are about 8 major levels of biological classification. And they differ from one another by a significant amount. So you can think of the successive classification levels as kind of the place values in a number, you know, the ones column and the tens column and the hundreds columns and so on. So since there are eight major biological classification levels, imagine an eight-digit number. And to make it more kind of concrete, think of a value of money in hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's six figures, and then the cents columns, the dimes and the pennies too. So there's eight digits there. Well, it turns out that the Darwin's finches, they have produced new species and new genera, a genus, that's the second lowest level, but nothing beyond that, nothing at the family level, which is the third level or higher. So essentially, they've changed the value of the money from, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars and say 17 cents to a couple hundred thousand dollars and 25 cents or so. And they have been there for 2 million years on the Galapagos Islands. They've been subject to very intense selection. They've apparently undergone many mutations. They would have had the chance to do so in that time. And yet there has pretty much only been a trivial change in those guys. What's more, only in the past few years, folks have sequenced the entire genome, the entire DNA of Galapagos finches. And in the year 2015, a large group sequenced the entire genomes of 120 different finches from the islands, including every species and every population group. And they found the mutation that was chiefly responsible for the birds having thin beaks or thick beaks. And it was in one developmental gene. And it turns out that the mutation damaged the gene or damaged the protein that the gene codes for. In other words, it made it less effective than it usually is. So for 2 million years, random mutation and selection have been grinding away, and all they managed to do was make a small change in a pre-existing gene in the direction of making it less effective than it used to be.
Huh. And to borrow a question that you yourself ask in this part of the book, how can mutations that damage protein function be positively selected in nature? And why is this a key thing to understand the limits of neo-Darwinism?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad I asked it. suppose that this one protein was responsible for making sure that beaks grew longer and thinner so that they could, say, probe a flower or something. Well, if that protein machine got damaged, then the beaks of the birds might not grow as long and might grow thicker than normal. In other words, they'd be short and stubby, and maybe accidentally that shape would help them to break some tough seeds in a drought or when softer food was not available. So it turns out that you can break something and the effects of it can be beneficial. And that turns out to be a key insight into appreciating what Darwin's mechanism is doing.
Well, would it be fair to say that Darwin's theory and the change it accounts for is only worth about $1.50?
Yeah, no, it's worth about 50 cents. The dollar is beyond it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. And this phenomenon, as I write in the book, is seen throughout a very wide variety of organisms, not only Darwin's finches, but fish too, called cichlid fish, and other birds called honey creepers in Hawaii, and anoles in the Caribbean, and plants and insects. And it seems to be a universal phenomenon that species can form when a type of animal or plant goes to a new area and diversifies. You can get new species, new genera, but nothing at the family level or higher. So it's only pennies that Darwin is responsible for.
Okay. Well, that's a great analogy. Good illustration. In part three of Darwin Devolves, you explain that Darwinian evolution is self-limiting. Can you explain that a little further?
Yeah. The idea is this, that species have to adapt to their environment. And so the fastest way that they can do that is by breaking genes that they already have. And as in the case of the Galapagos finches, sometimes that helps. Sometimes it helps to throw something away. And natural selection then comes along, and since it helped, it increases that in the population. So then that, in a little while, all the members of the population have that broken gene. At that point, the gene is gone forever. It doesn't get repaired. That would be much too improbable. So when another change of environment or another situation comes along and random mutation and natural selection have to work again, well, maybe another gene gets broken to help cope with that circumstance, and another one later on. And so the species gets to adjust to its environment, but it's kind of spending its genetic patrimony along the way. And eventually it gets to a point where it has used all the genes that can help it to adapt to changing circumstances, and it kind of gets stuck where it is and no longer can cope with changing environment, and it might go extinct or it might just stay where it is and not change further.
That's very interesting. Well, what do the guided evolution studies of Richard Lenski reveal about the limitations of natural selection?
Well, yeah, Richard Lenski is a microbiologist at Michigan State, and for the past 30 years, he has been growing a bacterium called E. coli in liquid culture in his lab, and he's been doing it just to see how the bacterium would change and evolve. And it turns out that these bugs have very short replication times, just an hour or so, so you can grow maybe 10 generations in a day, and wow. they grow in really large numbers. You know, you can get 100 million in a small flask. And so in the past 30 years, he's actually grown 60,000 generations of these bugs. And he's seen a number of helpful mutations come along. That is, it helps the bacterium grow faster and outcompete its siblings that don't have a particular mutation. For a long time, he wasn't able to track those mutations down. But as this technology improved, around the year 2000, he started to be able to find those mutations that were helpful. And they were overwhelmingly ones that broke or degraded genes that were already there. There was a gene that was responsible for making something called ribose, is a component of RNA. And that gene in the bacterium was obliterated, and it grew 5% faster. And in the year 2015, he and coworkers looked at the top 30 genes that had been selected over the past few decades that were helpful, and determined that pretty much all of them, there's a question about one or two, but pretty much all of them were ones that had been either broken or degraded. So his work is a wonderful illustration. You know, he wasn't looking for this result, but it's a great illustration that the fastest and easiest way to help a species adapt is by throwing something away that's already there, because it's easy to break a machine, a molecular machine like is in the cell. I mean, it's real, real difficult to make a machine, to construct one. So I'm a big fan of his, and I think his work is the definitive example of what Darwin's mechanism really does.
Interesting. Well, listeners can definitely read more about his work in your book. In Chapter 7, you focus on the first of three factors that you say limits Darwinian processes, random mutation. What have you found as you survey the data?
Well, random mutation, we are told, or we have been told, is the fodder for natural selection and therefore for evolution. And so just random changes that occur, some of them might help. And we have seen with the work that I describe in the book over the past few decades that, yes, random mutation does supply helpful changes for many organisms. But what we didn't expect was that these helpful mutations would be ones that broke genes, that broke things that were already there. And a lot of people say, you know, how can breaking something help? Well, suppose your life depended on your car getting better gas mileage. What could you quickly change? Of course, you could throw out the back seat. And you could take off the hood of the car and throw it away, and the trunk, and maybe even the doors, and decrease the weight. Those things have their uses, of course, in many circumstances. But if your life depended on you getting better gas mileage right now, then that would be the way to go. And it turns out that's the same thing with random mutation and natural selection. These bugs and organisms are looking for any advantage that they can get in the struggle to survive. And quite frequently, that's throwing something away. So now we know what random mutation does. And it does pretty much what people thought about it. It sometimes gives an advantage to an organism. But what we didn't appreciate was how it gives that advantage. And it gives it mostly by throwing things away.
Wow. Hence your title, Darwin Devolves.
Exactly. Yeah. These bacteria in Richard Lenski's laboratory and many other examples that I talk about in the book are changing and adapting not so much by evolution, but by devolution, by getting rid of things that they already had.
Well, this is fascinating discussion, and I'm looking forward to continuing it. Our time's up for today, but next time we'll discuss the two other factors that you say limits Darwinian processes. That's natural selection itself and irreducible complexity. And then in a final episode to our series, you'll give us a preview of the solutions you present to the problems surrounding evolutionary theory. So lots more still to come. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again, Andrew. I look forward to coming back.
Always a pleasure. Well, you can learn more about Michael Behe's new book at darwindevolves.com. That's darwindevolves.com. Listen to other episodes of ID the Future, including the rest of this series, wherever podcasts are found, or on the web at idthefuture.com. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thank you for listening.
Every summer, we invest in the next generation of scientists and thought leaders through Discovery Institute's annual summer seminars led by Stephen Meyer, Michael Behe, and others. Our 2019 seminar will be held July 5th through 13th at Seattle Pacific University, and application is open to college juniors, seniors, and graduate students. Available online now at discovery.org/SEM. Thanks to generous sponsorship, seminars are free and some travel grants are available, but space is limited. Apply at discovery.org/SEM now through April 2nd.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.